Senate Commerce Committee to order, and we have a number of bills that we have scheduled for today, I believe, for public hearing only. The first one we're going to take up will be Senate Bill 953, and Senator Avakian is going to come up with a couple of individuals, but before you get started, Anna, if you'd be so kind to just walk us through the summary on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 953 changes the definition of identity theft to include matters that have no pecuniary significance, adds to the crime of harassment subjecting another person under the age of 18 to offensive physical contact. Has no revenue impact. We haven't had a chance to get a fiscal impact statement back yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing the bill today. I want to introduce Jeremy and Melissa Gallagher, who are seated next to me, residents of Washington County, who had an experience in the past year that gave rise to my helping them with this bill. I'm going to let them talk a little bit about what it is that happened, and then I will briefly go over the bill a little bit and then be happy to answer questions from the committee.
Hi, my name is Melissa Gallagher. I guess thank you first for looking at this with us. We're really appreciative. How this started, we had a daughter about 2.5 years ago, and we both decided to work. We wanted to both continue working and decided that we wanted to bring someone, an individual, into our home to care for our child on a one-on-one basis. So we got a reference from a coworker and friend for somebody who to watch our daughter potentially. We met with her, checked her references. This woman seemed to be ideally what we were looking for. She was young lady like us. She had a lot of energy. She had early childhood education, volunteered at Dornbecker. She had done lots of child care before. Also, she was teaching as a color guard teacher with the high schools in the local area. So she was pretty active in the community, and we felt really, really good about her. We did end up hiring her. She was very responsible as far as we could see, always was on time, never late, very active in our child's life. Our child has a feeding disorder, and she has a feeding tube, which she's had pretty much her whole life. And she worked a lot at Dornbecker, so she was very familiar with the condition that she had, and she was very helpful, took direction really well. So we felt really at ease with her. After she had been working for us for about 6 months, our mutual friend who had originally suggested her and referred her to us brought it to our attention that, you know, there may be something that was out of place or didn't seem exactly right. Amy, which was the woman that was caring for our child, had posted a live journal page, which is basically an internet journal page which you can create for your friends to see, sort of like a MySpace. And you can tell about your life, etc. Well, on this, she had taken our daughter and completely changed her identity to her son. And she had gone to the extent of posting many applications about her pregnancy, the father who was now incarcerated or in jail. She also went over, you know, just our child's medical, all of the doctor's appointments, the medical conditions, everything was really included. And she put very specific details about her and her son, who was actually our daughter. She had gone to the extent of going down and during Christmas time taking pictures of our daughter as her son with Santa Claus. She had pictures of our daughter breastfeeding on her or attempting to breastfeed, but she wasn't actually producing milk. Just a wide variety of really disturbing things. And also, you know, tons of mentioning about how she was planning to move with her son to Canada. I'm not sure what her reasoning was for that, but she was planning to move away and they were going to start a new life there. So it was really big shock to us to see because we didn't see any, you know, significant signs. Of course, upon finding all this information, we ended up going to Washington County Police, asking them to take a look at, you know, legal action of what we should do in this situation, and kind of looking for guidance as to, you know, what we could do, because we felt, you know, she definitely betrayed it, betrayed our family, and, you know, our daughter, we'd spoken to many people that apparently were in play groups with our daughter, and she would attempt to breastfeed our daughter in front of these people at play groups, and apparently our daughter would scream and kick and try to get away from her. But there was never any ability to note that she was ever going to actually take our daughter, or that she would go through it, because she always brought her back at the end of the day. There was never any way that there could be any legal action from sex abuse, because breasts are not considered genitalia in the state of Oregon. So, and also, there was no way to prove that she got any sexual arousement from it. And there was, you know, other than that, there was no way, because our daughter was underage, to prove that this may have hindered her eating condition more, or prevented her from, you know, being more apt to eat, I guess.
Detective Don Vanderhey at the Washington County Sheriff's Department.
Go ahead and say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jeremy Gallagher. We did contact Washington County Sheriff's Department, and Detective Don Vanderhey was investigating the case, and nothing happened in regards to letting Amy DiGiovanni, which was our babysitter, letting her know that that wasn't right, which she did. We have a text phone call that we called her, my wife Melissa, called her, and it's on record that she admitted everything, and she admitted to having doing that. She was entreated with breastfeeding. The reason why they couldn't do anything is because Detective Vanderhey said that she couldn't prove her motive, as in, I don't still to this day know what her motive was, because we had no way to determine why she was doing that. And so therefore it did not get escalated to the district attorney, so then for them to determine whether or not she committed a crime. And that's why we're here today.
So I think the other thing that was a major concern for us is that we have since then found out that she did this to a family previous to us, and she is now watching children again.
Yes.
And we definitely want to prevent this from happening to any other families. This has been really heartbreaking.
And her mother was actually a charge nurse up at Dornbecker Children's Hospital for 32 years. So she was, and she went up to her mother's work frequently, and she was, you know, in the same presence of children all the time.
Mr. Chair, I think I also didn't identify myself. Brad Avakian, State Senator, District 17. And just to wrap up this experience, such a difficult thing for a family. Washington County District Attorney was unable to prosecute the case for actually the exact reasons that the Gallaghers just gave you. We had a very difficult time trying to figure out a way in order to provide some protection against this kind of abuse, since very difficult to prove motive and very difficult to prove harm when you have an individual of this age that can't testify about the harm. What we've done is we have amended the identity theft statute and the harassment statute, and we've done each in this way. I amended the identity theft statute so that if there is an intent to deceive or to defraud in some way, but not needing to prove any type of monetary harm in doing so, just using the intent to deceive or harm. And with the harassment statute, the difficulty often comes in the language of that's used to show that there was some type of physical contact that harmed somebody. We use the term offensive physical contact with somebody under the age of 18, which comes from an Oregon court case that says that you can use that language and use a reasonable person test or an objective standard just to show that a reasonable person could have been offended by the contact that had occurred. And with that way, the district attorney would have been able to prosecute this case. The last thing I'll note, just because I saw the packets you have, the copies did not show the pictures very clearly, but I'll describe them for you at least. The pictures were the ones that this woman posted on the Internet showing her with little Mia acting as Mia's parent. The picture of the two of them, one of them is the picture of the woman's bare breast mock breastfeeding the child, which was posted on the Internet. And then the other one, again, was a picture of the woman herself. And then the last thing I will note with regard to this story is the story went so far as to actually go through not just a pretend family that Mia had with this person as the mother, but clear through to an illness that the child suffered and the child's eventual death. And that story was played out on the internet. With that, Mr. Chair, I will close, and we'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator, I do have one question. I'm trying to grasp as to what the difference is on the modification of the harassment statute. And this will be on page 2. It's line 14 that would add this new component as to how that crime could be committed. And I'm trying to figure out what the differences are with line 11, because current law is harass or annoy another person by, and then A, subjecting such other person to offensive physical contact. And when I look at what is being added as or proposes the additional language, it seems like we're not going to have harasses or annoy another person, but just says subjects another person under the age of 18 to offensive physical contact. Don't we still have the same issue with, to me it is going to be a objective test by the trier of fact using, for all intent purposes, the reasonable person test as to determining whether or not that conduct was offensive physical contact?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair, and I would be pleased to take a shot at it, but I'm lucky enough to have Joshua Nasby in back of me, the legislative counsel, who came up with the language based on the old State versus Keller court case. And if it's all right, I'll give my chair up to him for just a moment.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Pajanski, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Nasby. I'm a deputy in legislative counsel's office. I'll get right to your question. Subsection A requires the state to prove that the person intended to harass and annoy, whereas so we've taken that out of subsection B. So in a prosecution for a person under the age of 18, the state wouldn't need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the mock breastfeeding was intended to harass and annoy.
So in the charging instrument, would it not still need a mental state?
Well, the intentionally in line 9, which is subsection 1, to answer your question, Chair Pajanski, yes. And it's the intentional in line in subsection 1 that's read into subsection B.
Okay. We'll talk later. I need some more clarity on this, because what I'm seeing is that we're basically, it looks like we're setting up a different test, and we're trying to somehow, and I don't know the court case that you're referring to, that allows for something's going to be less for a victim who's under the age of 18 as compared to someone that is of age.
I'm not sure I understood your question.
On line 14, the way it's modified, subjects another person, that person has to be under the age of 18. So we're now setting another standard that's going to apply to individuals that are under the age of 18 as compared to if they're over the age of 18, then they would still be under the current definition and statutes for harassment.
That's correct, Chair Pajanski. And in that case, with the person over 18, the state's going to have to prove that the defendant intended to harass and annoy the victim by subjecting them to offensive physical contact. And that offensive physical contact, even under sub A, is an objective standard.
So basically, if I drop from 9 and just say the person intentionally subjects another person under the age of 18 to what the jury would decide, or the judge as the trier of fact, to be offensive physical contact.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Was it the court case? Because you said harass and annoy, but line 10 and line page 2 is harass or annoy. So it seems to me like it could be either or already.
That's an absolutely fair point. I think that's an accurate description of the statute. It could be harass or annoy as it's written. But when we move down to the under 18, that entire alternative element is removed.
Okay. You may not have the answer now. In doing your research, did you look at other state statutes to see if what we're doing has been embraced in other states, or is this just based on our state case law for some other particular point that was used in that particular case?
Chair Pajanski, members of the committee, I can't tell you that offhand that I am familiar with other state statutes addressing this issue. This bill was drafted with a specific purpose in mind.
Understand. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Senator? Chair, and I don't know if Senator Bakken would come back, or I'm trying to figure out how what was done in this case would, if you're trying to approve the identity theft piece of it, the 165-800 edition, how this case would have deceived or defrauded. Does this case meet the test of that language? I guess it's a simply asked question.
Chair Pajanski, Senator Beyer. Long answer to a short question.
Question.
The identity theft statute right now doesn't specifically require financial damages. This insertion was added to make that perfectly clear to everyone involved that it could apply in a situation like this. The problem is we're bumping up in that area where free speech is implicated, and so the Oregon Court of Appeals has said the identity theft statute can only constitutionally be applied in cases where the person obtains a benefit they were not lawfully authorized to obtain. So we're kind of in that gray area between financial benefit and benefit generally in the Court of Appeals case, which they didn't elaborate on what that means. And so this bill is an attempt to kind of push it closer to the constitutional limits. But I think to answer your question directly, there is no requirement right now that it be a financial loss.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I thought the way I was reading it. So I'm just wondering how this case would be more defrauding and more deceptive than what's already in current statute.
It's an attempt to clarify existing law.
And if I could just follow up on that. If this individual actually, let's say, used this child to go in and get some benefit and reliance on that child being her child or whatever, then you're saying that that's pretty clear under the current statute of being able to, prove up the crime of identity theft, where by adding this new subsection, we're attempting to say that just the fact that they posed that this child was theirs when it wasn't, and even though they may not have received some type of direct pecuniary or monetary benefit, it still should qualify as a crime of identity theft.
Well, Chair Pajanski, members of the committee, I think even if this were to pass into law, we would still have that Article 1, Section 8 buffer that says there must be a benefit.
Okay.
But
right. Any other questions? Thank you. And, Senator, did you want to make some closing comments?
Just a final point, which I think you were hitting on, Chair and Senator Beyer both. This notion of benefit is the crux of the whole thing. Very clear that if somebody is deceiving or defrauding for a financial benefit, then the current statute holds. What do you do when somebody is receiving some benefit, even if it's some personal benefit that's not monetary in nature? Then the question for me, and the reason that I felt strongly enough to pursue a change in the law over this, is that people shouldn't be able, for whatever personal benefit they are pursuing something for, engage another person in some type of a deceptive manner, even if that's a minor, especially if it's a minor. So we're threading a needle through Article 1, Section 8 here in order to find protection for a victim that had no other way of being protected. And I think legally it fits, but it is a close call that may at some point need interpretation from the courts.
Okay, thank you. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate the witnesses bringing this to us. I lost a baby girl over 30 years ago, and I know what kind of pain you go through in this kind of a situation. What troubles me is this person that perpetrated this non-crime continuing this kind of activity and perhaps carrying it to the next step, a kidnapping or something of that nature. You know, this person obviously has serious problems, but she ought not to be caring for small children. She ought not to be touching small children. And so if we need to fix the law to try and protect future children from perhaps something even worse happening to them, then, you know, I think it's good that Senator Vakian brought this to us and that you folks were willing to kind of spill your guts in front of this committee.
I mean, we did have an issue. We contacted Channel 2 News, and they did do a story on it. We were on Channel 2 News, and they had quite a few people, and they that weren't clear on why the person was not actually prosecuted, and you know, they didn't know why as well, because they think automatically that it would be sex abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really prove her motive, and my daughter couldn't talk at age 6 months, so therefore we can't, you can't really say what she was doing. So therefore, you know, that's why we contacted Senator Vakian instead of taking the matter into our own hands, which...
I think that we both felt very strongly that exactly what you were saying, that we needed to push this and we needed to go farther no matter what we did, because right now we have not protected our daughter. We have no way of protecting her from this happening, but we've done everything that we can say now to protect other families. We've let them know this woman is here, this is what she's done, this can happen to you, you know, with the news, and now we're trying to do everything that we can to make sure we can say, yeah, we've done what we can to give people the protection they need, because this is really something, especially with our first child, that you would never expect, but it really robbed you of the whole experience when you run into something with, you know, a six-month-old child where you're happening, and then there's no protection whatsoever for her because she can't say, you know, this affected me negatively.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A little follow-up. I've seen a number of cases where a woman wanted a child so bad that they would take drastic action, steal somebody else's baby, mm-hmm. sometimes even kill a pregnant woman and steal the fetus, those kinds of things. So the behavior of this woman hadn't reached anything that drastic, but could.
Right,
could
and
in
she's
the future.
Watching other children, and she's
right.
done it before, so
yeah.
she obviously has an issue that is ongoing that no one's going to actively look at because she's not breaking any laws that are already in place.
Mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just checked. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 953? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 953, and we're going to go into the second bill.
684.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 684, and Anna, if you can give us an overview on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 684 has a -1 amendment that replaces the measure in its entirety. The amendment requires a permit from the Department of Business and Consumer Services to hold a going-out-of-business sale. Permit holders are required to inventory merchandise and provide affidavits for verification of sale items. The permit holder may not remain in business after 1 year from the date of the sale. It authorizes rulemaking and civil penalties by DCBS. Violations are an unlawful trade practice, allowing Attorney General enforcement and a private right of action. It declares an emergency effective on passage except the rulemaking provisions. All other provisions except the rulemaking provisions. We don't have a fiscal impact statement yet. It may have a revenue impact statement. We don't have that yet either. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Mexter, I know you're going to lead off. Do you have anyone else that you want to bring up?
Yes, the two gentlemen here to come with me.
And those two gentlemen are?
Tom Marentek, Mark and Tom. Tom Marentek.
Oh, okay. I got you. And do you also have Andrew that's going to be testifying later, too?
Yes, I think he from the Department of Justice
okay.
will be.
Okay. Senator, whenever you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and thank you for your consideration of the amended, thus new bill, Senate Bill 684. At least 25 states have regulations on going out of business sales, including Washington, and in fact the amendment before you, which replaces the bill, is essentially modeled after that in the state of Washington. What is the problem with unregulated going out of business sales? Well, endless sales that go on for months, even years. In fact, I will tell you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Atiyah, who is the president of Atiyah Brothers, who first brought this problem to me early in my legislative career about one particular business, is still going out of business.
Decades later.
I'm in my ninth year in the Oregon legislature. It provides discounts and undercut prices as other competitors, stores, deceptive pricing and false deals, since none of the sale merchandise is ever sold at regular price. Consumers have no idea if they're really getting a good deal. And there's a constant replenishment of stock. It's that old line, I have a limited supply, and if you buy this, I have a truck out back that has another limited supply. Why is this a good idea? Well, it encourages businesses to be good neighbors and fair to consumers by standardizing duration and manner of going out of business sales. It's an important piece of consumer protection, will ensure that consumers are getting the fairest deal. Some of the key points, and Mr. Marentat will go over the purposes of the bill. Sales are limited to 60 days. Extra merchandise cannot be brought in to boost proceeds from going out of business sale. Complete inventory must be given before and after the sale. No external parties can be brought in specifically for the purpose of conducting such a sale. And once the sale is completed, the owner and people involved in a sale are prohibited from reopening or joining a similar business for a year. What this says is that there are legitimate reasons, and the two gentlemen that are with me today who have experienced this firsthand will tell you there are legitimate reasons for having out-of-business sales. But if you're going out of business and you're trying to deceive the consumer, on the other hand, when you're really not going out of business, it's unfair to those involved in the legitimate businesses, number one, and number two, to consumers who feel they have to rush to buy something at a price that is almost always above a regular price at other competitors, and then to have that marketing practice not fair not only to the good people conducting business, but also to the consumers over and over and over again. This says there has to be a limitation on that. If you're really going out of business, be honest with the consumer that you're really going out of business and conduct the sale accordingly. You can have liquidation sales all you want, particular merchandise. You can have sales all day long, but if you're saying you're going out of business and this is a special one-time only deal, and you are using that to manipulate the consumer into buying things that he or she would not otherwise buy for the price they are buying, is not good consumer justice, and it certainly is not fair to legitimate businesses. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I think I'd like to turn it over, if it's okay with the chair, to Tom Marentat of Atiyah Brothers to give you more detail about the need for this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I am one of two owners of Atiyah Brothers and have been since 1986.
We're going to need you to put your name on the record just for the
record. My name is Tom Marentat.
Thank you, Tom.
You bet. We have been specialists in Oregon for over 107 years in the sales and care of rugs and wall-to-wall carpeting. Today, we successfully operate a retail store in Tigard, a full-service rug and carpet cleaning facility in Portland, and a similar cleaning operation in Eugene. We have approximately 55 employees on our payroll throughout all operations. My partner has historically managed the retail side of our business, while I have managed the cleaning side. The discussion today concerns issues more germane to the retail side of our business, and I apologize that my partner, who has more closely followed these issues for many years, is out of town and unable to be here. However, I will do my best to present our concerns and answer your questions. Obviously, we have worked a very long time in the floor covering industry and have earned a national and local reputation for our expertise, but even more important, a reputation for ethical and honest business practices. It is the strict adherence to honest business practices that not only allow us to belong to numerous trade and civic organizations, but have given us the privilege to found and lead such organizations. We believe very strongly that it is the honesty with customers that has kept us in business for over a century. Naturally, it hurts when we observe the complete dishonesty with customers that has plagued our industry, and I believe other industries in Oregon, for so many years. Going out of business sales can be and are a very legitimate mechanism for a business to liquidate its assets and truly move on from perhaps a disappointing effort to stay afloat or even to just move on to a new stage of life. However, in Oregon, the lack of any regulation of these sales allows those inclined to abuse the system to market misleading, completely false, and often fabricated information to the unsuspecting consumer. Most often, the false information includes listing of merchandise as part of the regular business inventory, when in reality, new merchandise is brought in continuously throughout the sale, often by an outside company from another state who specializes in phony going out of business sales. We seriously question where the taxes, if any are paid, end up with the resulting business activity. Listing of merchandise regular prices that are so far inflated that even the 65% discounts advertised result in sale prices beyond the prices we sell a similarly valued piece in our store every day, all year long. There's no end to the going out of business sale. In downtown Portland, there is a rug store that has been going out of business off and on since we changed our location in February of 2001. They continue to operate at the same address with the same name. A similar store in Portland has been heavily advertising a going out of business sale since January of this year and shows no sign yet of actually closing the doors, even though their ads have indicated final weeks since January. Most often, when a business finally locks the doors, they merely move a few blocks away, sometimes change their name, sometimes keep the same name, and do it all over again. Over the years, my partner has worked closely with the Department of Justice to bring attention to this ongoing problem. They have been very receptive and appropriately alarmed at what is going on within our state. We believe they share our frustration because at the end of the day, their efforts lack any ammunition. There simply are not appropriate regulations in the state of Oregon to curb this consumer fraud. The problem is further compounded by the fact that most other states do have appropriate regulations, and Oregon has therefore become a safe haven for all the unscrupulous professional managers of going out of business sales from around the country. Oregon has become a dumping ground for poor quality merchandise sold to our consumers through deception. When the Iranian embargo was still in place, it was the phony going out of business sales in Oregon that served as a pipeline to introduce illegal Iranian rugs into the states. It's time for Oregon to address this problem and bring honesty back into our environment. Thank you.
Mark, were you going to be testifying?
Nothing specific, no.
Okay. Then I'll open up the panel for questions at this point. Gentlemen, I think you're off the hook. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have on the same panel, or was is Andrew Shaw. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Patrick Allen to also please come up. Andrew?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Andrew Scholl, Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. The Oregon Department of Justice supports the going out of business law concept from a general consumer protection viewpoint. As has already been alluded to, there are many issues with how going out of business sales are sometimes set forth in the state of Oregon. Some consumers are magnetically drawn to the words going out of business more so than, say, for the routine use of the words clearance or sale. Consumers expect going out of business sales to offer discounts far below those in normal sales for items that often fetch a premium price. Because of the strength of terms like going out of business and similar phrases, some states specifically regulate these sales, including, as you've heard, our neighbors to the north, Washington. Oregon does not have a specific going out of business law, and instead those protecting consumers in the marketplace make do by citing general definitions of misleading advertising and broad consumer protection laws. An example of this is misrepresenting the reasons for, existence of, or amounts of price reductions, which is a general violation of the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, as has also already been alluded to. The simple fact of the matter is how some of these are set up, and because there is no specific regulation statute, there are issues with prosecuting many of these under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And despite these provisions, without the specific language setting the limits of a going out of business sale, a retailer may hold a seemingly perpetual going out of business sale, as you've heard. And this not only entices consumers to shop for items that may be of lower quality or higher prices than thought, but it also unfairly competes with businesses that do not use these inappropriate terms for everyday sales or clearances. The current going out of business laws in other states often limit the length of such sales because a true going out of business sale can be completed in a relatively short period of time. As someone has already stated, going out of business sales can have very legitimate uses for businesses that are looking to liquidate and close their doors. In addition, current laws from other states typically bar or limit the amount and nature of goods that a retailer can add to its existing stock of merchandise during such a sale. There are two strong reasons for this. First, the new merchandise may be of lesser quality, misleading consumers who expect to be buying the same quality of product normally sold by the store. And adding new merchandise is inherently misleading. You've already heard that some stores will simply have merchandise coming in the back door. Stores that advertise a closing sale while continuing to add new inventory can delay completion of the going out of business sale, again, seemingly perpetually. When a legitimate retailer is going out of business, the public and law enforcement assume that the business will liquidate its current stock and close its doors. Under going out of business laws, a company is given a reasonable amount of time to accomplish this very task. So with that, a state going out of business law will assist in continuing to protect a fair and honest marketplace here in Oregon. It's beneficial to businesses, as you've heard from the Atiyah brothers. It's beneficial to Oregon consumers. I thank you for your time, and I can definitely attempt to answer any questions for you.
All right, we'll hold off on the questions. Patrick?
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. DCBS does have some concerns with the Dash 1 amendments, and particularly the licensing scheme as proposed as a way of doing this regulation. Unquestionably, there are abuses and issues that need to be dealt with. We're concerned that as an agency, we don't have any kind of current regulatory responsibility nor experience with retail business at all. I think you've heard Ms. Braun say that there's not a fiscal yet. There will be a fiscal associated with a bill like this. We'll need to create capacity and expertise in the agency that we don't currently have. By making violation of parts of the bill an unlawful trade practice, you're going to split enforcement of the act into two different agencies. We believe that's potentially going to cause confusion and concern for people who are trying to pursue redress. As you heard, it's already a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act to misrepresent prices. But I guess I'd like to just finally and quickly say, while pursuing bad actors, consider someone who's actually going out of business. Whether it's because their business has failed or because they're retiring or whatever else, that person whose business is going to end has to determine that they in fact need this license. They're going to have to fill out forms, pay a fee, take a detailed before and after pricing inventory, get that inventory page by page notarized, be able to sell for 60 days. At the end of 60 days, if unfortunately they've not managed to sell all their stuff, as I read the bill, they can't extend that period. It looks like they can't even take the stuff home and sell it on eBay. Maybe some questions if someone walks up and says, well, I'll buy the business from you. Could they even do that? My fear would be in creating a hammer to go after bad actors, we may take people who really are going out of business and put them through a real ringer. And still the bad actors, being bad actors, will be creative and find ways to act badly. So we've got some concerns about the way the Dash 1 does this registration requirement, but we'd be happy to work with you on alternatives.
Great, thank you. Questions first? Floyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first thing that comes to my mind is if whether or not this is somewhat treading or closely treading again on the free speech clause. I understand it's already illegal to falsely advertise, but the kind of phrases that you can't use, does that give the Department of Justice any concern that you're getting pretty close to free speech issues here?
Chair Metzger, Senator Beyer, I don't have an answer to that question. Again, we're speaking on the general consumer protection benefits of a going out of business law. We haven't actually been intricately involved in drafting this bill. We supplied some other states' statutes. My understanding is it closely mimics other states' statutes, so I would think that a constitutional issue, if it were presented, could be researched by my office fairly easily.
I guess it's a fault in the statement. My question would be, or maybe it's a question in there. You said, or you or Senator Metzger said it mirrors Washington's law. I don't know if Washington's constitution is as broad or as interpreted as broadly as our constitution when it comes to free speech and expression. And I guess it's just something I'd want to have checked out.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Sounds like the Department of Consumer and Business Services does not want to take on any additional work. That may be unfair, but you're going to have to say more to me about what other alternatives you see for addressing the issue and the problem that has been outlined for us. I also want to hear something about the 25 states that have this legislation in place. What's the monitoring agency? How do other states, how have they implemented the law?
Chair Posansky, Senator Gordley, I would have to get back to you on that. I do recall in looking at old laws quite some time ago that there were some that had of these similar registration or permitting requirements, but with local county clerks. I don't know if Washington's, I don't know if the reason ours ended up with DCBS is because Washington's has a more central database than that.
Mm-hmm. Is this an issue, if I may follow up,
right.
Is this an issue that has, or a subject of consumer protection that has come up before in a way that has caused the Department of Justice and DCBS to talk together? Or is this the first time we're having the conversation about this particular policy issue?
Chair Przyjanski, Senator Gordley, again, I'd have to check with my office to get back with you on that. But for my experience, it's the first time the concept's sort of been discussed as a dual enforcement mechanism between the two agencies.
Chair Przyjanski, Senator Gordley, to both questions, I would also need to check and see whether we've dealt with this issue jointly previously. In terms of more work, the department, if we're allocated resources to do work, we'll do work. I was simply trying to identify that this is an area where we have no expertise, no current programs, no efforts that deal with this. So that's a hindrance to us in doing this. In terms of alternatives, because we don't have that expertise, it's not an area I'm expert, but it certainly seems as though if there are behaviors we want to be illegal, we've got certain behaviors now that are codified in the Unfair Trade Practices Act, Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and we could look, for instance, at those provisions and see are there ways that they could be tightened up or conversely broadened or in some other way, you know, make the things that are bad actions themselves illegal as distinguished from setting up a registration and licensing system.
And if I may, that's where I was going to, I guess, kind of divert us. It seems to me, based on I had a little preview of this, as to the DCBS not being in a position now to currently do this, and we'll take, sounds like, new resources, set up a new department or a component within one. It would seem to me that what we need to do is focus on the unlawful trade practice components and whether or not we could capture the intent of the bill and have it enforced through the Department of Justice that already has that already in place. Specifically, I think the questions that I would have is where you have someone that is using the term or phrase going out of business sell and knowing that they are not doing so. I don't know what the framework would be. Maybe some other state statutes can give us that understanding of how that could be worded to make that where that would be an unlawful trade practice that could, in fact, be enforced by the Department of Justice. Because to me, I think that's the part that I'm hearing is probably more at the heart of what we're trying to do and trying to set up a framework of how long it takes someone to go out of business. I don't feel comfortable with that as I've heard the discussions at this point. But clearly where someone is using a tactic to get business and really isn't being honest and forthright with the public, and does in fact impact their competitors by using those type of catch terms or phrases, that is its thing I think I would be more comfortable in trying to address. So with that, I'm going to ask Andrew if you and the consumer protection group could actually maybe look at what's happened in the other states, other statutes, working with Senator Metzger and his staff to make certain that we can in fact look at something that might be a little bit more narrow and still keep us within the framework of not violating free speech and expression.
Chair Posansky, absolutely. We can work with Senator Metzger's office.
All right. Any other questions or comments? No, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I've got three other people that were signed up, and I just want to make sure they do or don't want to talk, because I think they may have thought we had another bill coming down the pike, which was just the straight 681. Of course, what we'll take is testimony on the dash ones or any comments that came out today. And I'm seeing Mr. Marquis probably does not want to testify at this time. Jeff Hansen does not want to testify. And Mark Comstock, Mr. Comstock, does not want to testify. So if there's anyone else who'd like to give comment on Senate Bill 684 as it would be impacted by the dash ones, please come forward. If not, we'll close the public hearing on 684 at this time. We're going to go open up our last public hearing we have scheduled for today. This is on Senate Bill 561. And Anna, if you'll give us an overview. John, I see that you're here and wanting to testify. It doesn't say what your positions are. Are you for or against?
For.
All right, John, why don't you go ahead and come up. And Norton Cable? Cable?
And I can do the summary. I promised Anna that I would do this, and I have to give it to you.
All right, well, I don't want to get myself in trouble, so John, if you'd be so kind to give us that summary, and I'll probably sleep better tonight by not worrying about it all night.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. My name is John Van Landingham. I work at the Legal Aid Program in Eugene for Lane County. I'm here with Norton Cable. I am a member of something called the General Landlord-Tenant Coalition. It's a coalition of landlords and tenants that have negotiated amendments to state landlord-tenant law and has been in existence since the early 1980s, although none of us have been doing this that long. I've been doing it since 1989. Norton is younger than I am. Norton is a landlord. I'm a tenant advocate. So this coalition has produced a bill this session. It's Senate Bill 561. The dash one amendments would do the following. I'm going to briefly summarize the handout that I just had distributed to you. It gives more detail, but I'm going to sort of summarize what the main things that are in the bill. The first is that we create in sections one and two a new simplified repair and deduct for defects that are that would cost $300 or less to repair. There's an existing statute that allows repair and deduct. It's too complicated. Nobody ever uses it. What we're trying to do is make it usable for tenants, and we worked this through the coalition as part of our discussion about mold. Is there something we can do in the Act to address mold? And we concluded working with tenant advocates that the real problem for them is, well, we can't do anything about mold, but two, the real problem for them is there's no good effective repair and deduct remedy. So that's what this hopes to do. It's a simplified form. Tenants can do this without running a whole bunch of risks as they do in the current law. Sections 3 through 7 and 9 through 11 adopt a whole bunch of new things regarding domestic violence and how domestic violence, victims of domestic violence are treated under landlord-tenant law. And I've outlined those in detail, and if you have questions, I'd be glad to go through those things. And Sybil Hebb is also here, who is our DV expert within the coalition. Section 8 deletes 9365 sub 3, which is the existing repair and deduct provision, and is the one that doesn't work, so we're replacing that one and deleting it. Sections 12 and 13 amend statutes in the FED statutes. Chapter 105 is the authority for court actions enforcing evictions. And those two statutes we want to amend to delete the provision for the landlord to list the Social Security number of the tenant. We've done a similar sort of thing in domestic cases, and that's part of an effort to minimize the risk of identity theft. So we don't want those Social Security numbers on a public document, an FED, that somebody could go in and find it. Section 14 is related to the DV stuff and also includes a clarification about what happens in an FED when a landlord dismisses an FED prior to trial. And what we've written there reflects some recent case law. Our theory in the coalition has always been that it's better to have the statutes reflect what the law is, since most landlords and tenants are not represented by lawyers and don't know what the Oregon Court of Appeals might or might not say. So we've tried to implement that, those recent holdings in the statute regarding dismissals. 15 as a cross-reference. 16 and 17 would allow landlords and tenants in FEDs where the current statute calls for an affidavit, would allow them to use a declaration. Affidavits have to be sworn. Declarations don't. ORCP now allows declarations. It's a more direct statement about what you're risking by if you're lying on this document. And what we want to do is authorize landlords and tenants to use declarations instead of affidavits in the FED world. And then 18 allows the courts to use up existing older forms, since we're amending them and we don't want to make them throw them away. So that's the summary of the bill. I think Norton would describe how we got there.
So my name is Norton Cabell. I own and manage about 75 rental units, mostly in Eugene, where I live. For the past decade or so, I've been a member of the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, helping to find legislative solutions to conflicts between landlords and tenants. I own property in several states, and I believe Oregon is unique in the way it develops landlord-tenant law. So it was over 20 years ago that your forebears, believing the landlords and tenants were better qualified to craft solutions to their own problems, pushed the advocates to negotiate between themselves. And that's what's happened. Over the years, the coalition has worked on major changes, made major changes to late charges and other fees, landlord remedies, transfer of possession, abandoned property, alcohol and drug-free housing, and a whole lot more. In no other state is there such a successful collaborative effort to negotiate changes to landlord-tenant law. Active participants in the coalition include the three major landlord trade groups, Metro Multifamily Housing Association, Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, and Oregon Rental Housing Association, and the major tenant advocates, the Community Alliance of Tenants, the Oregon Law Center, and Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. Other participants include the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and the City of Corvallis' Housing Code Program, as well as several attorneys. We have met continuously over the past 2 years, and we've studied a variety of subjects. We've not always found solutions. John mentioned mold. We spent months talking about this subject, but since we learned that some mold results from tenant actions, behaviors, some from property disrepair, and still more from a combination of those and other factors, we couldn't find a legislative solution. And solutions don't always come easily because the problems usually are not simple. So we've spent the whole 2 years talking about domestic violence, in part because new federal law imposes requirements on housing authorities and Section 8 landlords and grants new rights to their tenants. Some landlords, whom I represent, recommended we do nothing to accommodate those subject to the new law. Some tenant advocates wanted to expand the rights given tenants under the new law. Senate Bill 561, which is typical of the work of the coalition, found a middle ground, creating rights to protect legitimate victims of domestic violence, while giving landlords some flexibility to deal with perpetrators of violence as well as victims who allow those perpetrators to continue to threaten others on the premises. Other subjects in the bill, like legal fees for FED actions and tenants' right to deduct the cost of repairs, as John talked about, similarly respond to the needs of both sides. It's truly compromise legislation. So besides being legislative director of Oregon Rental Housing Association, I'm a member of, and today I'm pleased to represent Metro Multifamily Housing Association and Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, and in that role, or actually in those roles, I urge you to support Senate Bill 561.
All right. Questions? And when we're talking about 561, we're talking about what would be the dash ones?
Correct.
Yes,
sir.
Yes, okay. Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Mr. Van Landingham, why are we removing references to elder abuse from the statute?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Gordley, we didn't negotiate. That statute is something the coalition negotiated and produced 4 years ago. At the time, we didn't think through the role of elder abuse with DV, and there's some different nuances. We didn't work with the elder abuse advocates. We've never discussed this with them one way or the other, and we just don't think it's the same dynamic as with domestic violence. We're not trying to take anything away from them. I don't believe any elder abuse advocates have ever used these particular statutes to one way or the other.
But the effect of the amendments is that the elder abuse references would be removed from statute. Is that correct?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Gore, that's correct.
Can you point me to the language in the amendments where that language would be removed?
The amendments are, I don't think we actually have the amendments per se.
We have the dash one.
But we got a dash two that's coming?
There's other amendments that are coming, is my understanding.
Okay.
Not from me.
Okay.
If the committee wants to move the bill today, we won't do further amendments. We have some other things that you're familiar with, the struggles with amendments these days, this session, and so we could make it a better product if you didn't move it today. But they're not things that we would fall on our sword over, unless Senator Gorley, for example, has other.
Why don't we finish this dialogue and then we'll come back as to. At this point, I was not planning on moving it today, but I guess I want to move clearance as to whether any additional amendments might be in the process. But let's go ahead. Answers Senator Gordley's questions.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Gordley, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and I think I can speak to your concern when two sessions ago when we were negotiating the initial protections that are currently embodied in Oregon law, we inadvertently listed the elder abuse statutes that authorize protective orders as one of the forms of proof that one could use to submit showing that one was a victim of domestic violence. It was an inaccurate, they don't cross-reference correctly. The discussion of elder abuse is, of course, one that's of great importance. It's a slightly different dynamic, and the protection systems that are in place handle, they have different standards of proof, and they provide different types of protection than are currently available under the restraining order statutes for domestic violence victims. And it was an inadvertent listing of those statutes that authorize those protection orders as a form of proof for a different category of victims. And so this is sort of cleaning that up. The substantive discussion of whether or not elder abuse victims should be included in this bill was not one that's been discussed either previous sessions or during this session.
But to answer the specific question, the deletion is found on page 16 of the dash one amendments on line 23. It's an existing statute. The existing statutes allow DV victims to terminate their tenancies early in order to flee. That's one thing they do. So that they, instead of having to give a 30-day notice, the victim can give a 14-day notice and leave early and move away from the abuser. They also allow the victim to lock out or change the locks, which is not something that tenants normally can do. Normally only the landlord could change the locks. But we're authorizing in this case for DV victims to change the locks in a different statute. But in 90.453, there's a list there of cross-references to other statutes, and those are the elder abuse statutes. Nowhere else in the statutes do we talk about elder abuse.
If I may, John, it sounds to me from what Sybil has said, those two statutes that would be deleted were inadvertently included before, and it wasn't intended at the time that they were put in there to be part of the statute. It's just an oversight through our process, and we're just trying to clear that up, not to take away from the importance of maybe providing safeguards for individuals suffering through elder abuse, but it was not part of what actually became the current statute under ORS 90.453.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
It seems to me that we would want to make sure that the record is clear that protections around elder abuse are found elsewhere in the statutes as it may relate to these kinds of issues, that we need to be explicit about that?
I believe it is. I think all we're doing here is based on what's currently in ORS 90.453. It makes reference to sections that are the elder abuse, which is 124.015 and 124.020. Those two statutes, from all indications, are they're staying on the books.
Correct.
All we're doing is taking those two notations out of this section because it inappropriately refers to something that was not contemplated when this statute was changed previously.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. And Senator Beyer.
Just a clarification. I see, John, in Section 10, you're removing the same two references, so the same issue. It's on page 23, line 25.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, you're doing a better job than I am, yes.
Excuse me, Section 11, not Section 10.
I see it. Yes. Those three statutes are the statutes that the legislature passed 4 years ago, as I said, to allow early termination and to allow victims to lock out the abuser. And so they were cross-referenced in both statutes, and they'd be removed in both statutes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments? Senator Gordley, did you? I'm going to leave everyone here until you have a chance to look at that statute to see if you have any other questions. While we're waiting on that, let me just ask, my understanding, John, from your testimony, that there may have been some other, let's call it house cleaning or phrases or terms that could be added to another amendment that would clarify what we're working on now. There's two ways, of course, we can handle that. We could do it here, and we do have time. We have 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks before Senate bills need to, let's say, be concluded on the Senate side. So if that's something that you'd like to do now, I'd be very comfortable holding the bill until then. If this is something that's going to take some period of time to get those amendments together because it's a redrafting and revamping of things that are not currently in here, then I guess I need to know that, because then I need to decide on whether we want to see that before it goes to the House, or do we let it go to the House first.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that the amendments would be complicated. An example that you would appreciate is that in one part of the bill we're saying that, especially with regard to the DV stuff, that if a landlord files an FED against a victim not knowing that the cause of the termination is domestic violence, and then the landlord finds out about it, and if the landlord promptly dismisses the FED, then the landlord would not be able to recover costs, or the tenant would not be able to recover costs and disbursements from the landlord as the prevailing party, despite the dismissal. For some reason, this draft doesn't say costs. It just says disbursements. I can't explain why. I don't see any reference in ORS to anything other than costs and disbursements, always the two terms together. So, you know, is it going to hurt us if it doesn't say costs and disbursements? I don't know. If it were perfect, we'll, and maybe next time I'd come back and fix that, assuming that I don't retire in the meantime.
Wait, unless someone has any objection, I'd like to go and just hold the bill now, because that seems a very quick fix that can be done by LC to bring it in compliance. That way we'll have everything done and not have to worry about it being, one, maybe fixed on the House side and then have to come back for concurrence. So unless anyone else has any questions, I'm going to go ahead and close. Well, first let me ask, I see Sean's in the back. Ms. Miller, did you want to make any comment today? All right, if not, if there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 561, please let me know. If not, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561. We will hold that bill to allow the parties to get the redrafting of whatever additional amendments need to be done, and then we will go ahead and schedule that for work session as soon as that's done, and we'll move the bill out at that point. Any other comments, questions, Anna, anything for us?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. We'll be adjourned until, I assume, Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Thank you, everyone.